Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. This book was one of the Book Review's 10 best books of 2023. Chain Gang All-Stars by Nana Kwame Aji-Brenya. Should I be having this much fun? This is one queasy's testament to Nana Kwame Aji-Brenya's talent. You cannot applaud his debut novel, Chain Gang All-Stars, without getting blood on your hands. To enjoy the action is to share in the guilt of the bloodthirsty fans sitting ringside at the live broadcast death matches between prison inmates. Aji-Brenya is so good at writing fight scenes that our moral disgust never definitively stamps out the primitive thrill of reading them. This is also why his book works. It is an act of protest, but it does not straightforwardly preach. Instead, it lures you in, as if to demonstrate how easy it might be to accept a world this sick. Even readers who acknowledge the brazen evil of the dystopian premise, these televised duels offer prisoners a path to freedom, might find themselves titillated by its depiction, which functions as both satire and straight-up sports writing. The lulls between bouts give readers a beat to think about all the ways they've been conditioned to enjoy such a story by any number of America's perversions, its narcotic televised pastimes, its singular talent for mass incarceration, its steady innovation in violence technology, its racial caste system, its eternal appetite for retribution. But it's fun, I promise. And yet, as much as this book made me laugh at these parts of the world I recognized as being mocked, it also made me wish I recognized less of it. The United States of Chain Gang All-Stars is like ours, if sharpened to absurd points and flung a few decades into the future. Its most famous athlete is Loretta Thurwar, our protagonist, beloved for bashing her peers to death with a large hammer. In her anonymous prior life, she was convicted of killing a lover. After opting into the Criminal Action Penal Entertainment, CAPE, program, Thurwar left the confines of a private prison and entered a more glamorous kind of captivity. These prisoners, known as links, belong to teams called chains, which trudge all day long in marches all over the country. Periodically, they arrive at arenas to fight links from rival chains to the death. These battles are presented for the world as pay-per-view sports. The rest of their daily lives, full of internal politics and wanton bloodshed, are packaged as episodic reality television. All this exposure leads to towering celebrity. The top fighters occupy a paradoxical place in society, the incarcerated influencer, as if Spartacus were churning out SpawnCon on his off days. Grocery stores and fast food chains vie for precious ad space on Thurwar's skin and clothing. Drivers and soldier police officers shepherd these celebrities to news conferences and civic engagement days. "Your subjects are waiting, convict," one guard says to a popular fighter about to greet a rapt audience, compressing the irony into 5 words. Before fights, the star talent leads fans in call-and-response chants, working in an idiom that's equal parts Muhammad Ali, boom-bap rap, and Zen Koan. This sport profits hugely from these athletes' charisma, which is in most cases unmistakably black, while keeping them enslaved with electronic wrist restraints. This book is not shy with its allegories. After a triumph on the killing grounds, a fighter earns points with which to upgrade weapons or food or lodging, as if the prison commissary had drawn inspiration from a role-playing video game. What all these fighters seek is freedom, a word that appears capitalized throughout the book, like a term of art or faith. It comes in 2 types, low freedom, death, however it might find them, and high freedom, pardon, commutation, or clemency after 3 years survived on the circuit. This whole scheme is laid out in a voice that belongs only to Ajay Brenya, who bends the lurid into the lyrical. Pretty words about hideous deeds. Some of his best fight sentences sound as if Joe Rogan had fallen into a trance and assumed the diction and rhythms of Toni Morrison. If you recoil at that unholy fusion, that's kind of the point. And the author keeps pulling off the shock, page after page. Ajay Brenya has a fine intuition, an almost spatial sense for what we need to see and what we don't. His names are crisp, like Sunset Harkless, a man, and Spinifer Black, a spear, and his compact euphemisms a gift. When the incarcerated fight to the death for the public enjoyment, it is marketed to bros as hard action sports. One such audience member, catching a ray of pseudo-enlightenment, realizes that watching a woman bash people to death for 3 years has turned him into a feminist. There's more than a little George Saunders in these hijinks, and it is no surprise to see him thanked as a mentor in the acknowledgments. The novel is a thorough display of authorial control. Ajay Brenya only ever loses his handle on the pace and the tone in a few meandering dialogues between Thurwar and her team and soulmate, Hurricane Stax. Some people in this imagined society protest the institution of CAPE, but many, many more happily fold it into their pop cultural diet. Enthusiasts have figured out how to push headlong through the cognitive dissonance of enjoying live murder. That friction creates most of the novel's grim humor, which will be familiar to anyone whose favorite entertainment has an unavoidable human cost. One viewer slowly warms up to this sick spectacle as a study in humanity that she decided any intellectual, socially aware person at least had to peruse. It was a part of the cultural conversation. Even if she was ambivalent about its ethics, she couldn't pretend it wasn't an interesting part of the world. Straight out of a thinking fan's defense of the NFL. Of course, in addition to the damage wrought by the entertainment industry on our public conscience, Ajay Brenya is concerned with the state's harm to those citizens it deems beyond saving. Chain Gang All-Stars is honest about the inhumanity of incarceration and the increasingly elaborate mechanisms we build in place of forgiveness and rehabilitation. As the plot careers forward, Ajay Brenya uses footnotes as tethers between fiction and reality, reminding us that his gladiatorial farce is just a little tragicomic leap from an extant American horror. At the bottom of the page, he might stash bits of the U.S. Penal Code or the Geneva Conventions, eulogies for real-life victims of police violence, solitary confinement, and wrongful conviction. He presents potent arguments for abolition from the fighters themselves and the activists supporting them from the outside, and for the brutal logic against it, voiced by the operators of these games, who believe them to be a deterrent to crime. A form of absolution for those who otherwise do not deserve it, and, conveniently, a source of their own personal enrichment. A writer who was up to the ideological but not the emotional task of such a novel might have settled for thinner characters. But Ajay Brenya, flitting from perspective to perspective in brisk chapters, assumes all of them easily and fills the characters' inner lives to the brim. Especially those of the incarcerated. These people navigate their feelings of permeating, heartbreaking guilt, but also their wellness routines, fickle romances, creaky joints, fading memories of civilian life, inane daydreams. The society in which they live defines them by their worst deeds, but the writer of this novel refuses to. This review was written by Jiri Nathan, who is a writer and co-founder of Defector Media. This book was one of the Book Review's 10 best books of 2023. The Fraud by Zadie Smith. All over the dorm in California glinted pale orange and Tabasco red and steel blue copies of Zadie Smith's White Teeth with their hard white bright lettering. The year was 2001. and white teeth had been assigned as incoming reading for my freshman dorm. I remember loving the sprawling, rude, funny, slapdash narration, the magical way in which Smith brought it all together in the figure of a genetically engineered mouse. But Smith's age at the time, 26, must have felt positively geriatric to me. It was only when I started publishing in my 20s that I could appreciate what a prodigy Smith was, and throughout my career she has remained a startling and despair-inducing beacon of what a writer can achieve at a young age. An undergraduate when she embarked on White Teeth, she was not yet 30 when she published, to my mind, her masterpiece, On Beauty, a wise, sad, and hilarious book about American race relations that would have justly been called a great American social novel had the American literary scene at the time been more attuned to race as a theme. Now, at the ripe old age of 47, Smith, having long since entered history herself, has written her first historical novel, The Fraud. It offers a vast, acute panoply of London and the English countryside, and successfully locates the social controversies of an era in a handful of characters. The fraud of the title refers to several figures, but primarily to a scamster in 1860s England who claims to be Sir Roger Tichborne, the inheritor of a great title and fortune, who was considered dead at sea. Suing to take over the Tichborne estate, the claimant, as he is called, is clearly a fraud. He has none of the trappings of an aristocrat, and everything about his past suggests that he is an English butcher who has been living in Australia to escape bad debts. But strangely, in his quest for justice, the claimant amasses an adoring swarm of fans who believe he is telling the truth and are ready to go to the death to prove that he, and no one else, is Sir Roger. The only reason the claimant is being denied his due, these supporters say, is that the elite, the gentry, the press, the papists, are in conspiracy against him. The echoes of mindless Trumpism are clear, and it is evidently why Smith was drawn to this trial, which was a cause celeb in England at the time, and was a bottomless well of populist nuttiness. The diverse crowd of the claimant's supporters at a fundraiser, Smith writes, consisted of clerks and schoolteachers, dissenters of all stripes, shopkeepers and foremen, ladies' maids, cooks, governesses. The claimant was a man with no center, who moved as the wind moved, a fun-loving, beer-swilling, aristocratic man of the people. What better way to write about Trump and Trumpism than to avoid flattering Trump with another Trump portrait? But this is a novel, and the novelist's intelligence is drawn in idiosyncratic directions. What makes The Fraud a book by Zadie Smith and not, say, a transcript of the trial that is the central characters are not the jury or the judged, but a 60-ish Scottish widow named Eliza Touche and an elderly, formerly enslaved Jamaican named Andrew Bogle, who is serving as a witness for the claimant. Touche is the most morally intelligent character Smith has written, a spiky, questing, watchful, death-haunted individual who is funny without being comic. A housekeeper and editor to her bumbling, graphomaniac novelist cousin, modeled and named after a real writer, William Ainsworth, she spends her days in the countryside, protecting Ainsworth's fragile ego. His reputation is in decline, while his opportunistic friend, Charles Dickens, has been buried in Westminster Abbey and arguing about the Tichborne case with Ainsworth's new, much younger, working-class, barely literate, former maid wife, Sarah, who is as pro-claimant as one can get. These mealtime debates about the Tichborne trial, while fun to follow, lack the preternatural precision of the dialogue in Smith's more contemporary novels. She is working with the past and can't rely on her superb ear. And so the novel really takes off when Eliza accompanies Sarah to the Tichborne fundraiser in London and finds her mind blown by the riotous circumstances and, by contrast, the sobering figure of the white-haired, neatly dressed Andrew Bogle up on the stage. Many idiots are compelled to defend the claimant, including an Irish lawyer who appears to be modeled on Rudy Giuliani. But of all his defenders, no one is more believable, cautious, or intelligent than Bogle, who knew the claimant in Australia and has maintained, mysteriously, even in the face of legal blows to the claimant, that the claimant is who he says he is. As an abolitionist and student of humanity, Touche is inexorably drawn to Bogle and begins interviewing him with the hope, after years of being on the sidelines of literary dinner conversations, of, heaven forbid, writing her own book. More so than any other novel Smith has written, this is a book about novelists. It is in lambasting the egos of male writers that Smith has the most fun. God preserve me from that tragic indulgence, that useless vanity, that blindness, Touche thinks, years before she takes the plunge into novel writing herself. While discussing Dickens with Ainsworth, she exclaims, "Oh, what does it matter what that man thinks of anything? He's a novelist." One of her cousins' orotund historical fictions about the court of Queen Anne is described as being almost as dull as the reign of Queen Anne itself. More movingly, Smith explains in one passage why Ainsworth became a bad writer of historical fiction after a major controversy around his early, successful, contemporary novel Jack Shepherd drove him off into the distant, storied past, where he felt safest, where nothing is real and nothing matters. It is less easy, from this point, to see Ainsworth as a buffoon. And it is a way for Smith to signal to us why she, too, may wish to navigate the storms of the present on a raft fashioned from the timber of the past. Bogle, meanwhile, tells Eliza his harrowing tale of being raised on a brutal Jamaican plantation and making his way to England as a valet. "My life has had many parts," he says, sounding like a Naipaul narrator. It is in this section that the odd structure of the novel, cutting between time periods and characters in very short chapters, has its biggest payoff, with decades racing by in bite-sized passages that yield first-rate observations about colonialism, like this: "England was not a real place at all. England was an elaborate alibi." More often, though, the book's structure is uneven. One wishes, for instance, that the chapters would signal their time jumps more consistently, so that one wasn't wondering if one was with the Eliza of the 1830s or the 1870s. But these infelicities stop mattering when we are deep into the trial and the book turns into a portrait of people with thwarted ambitions, of people who, like Ainsworth, become frauds without knowing it. In all of her books, Smith has paid attention to a mixed-up London and particularly to Willesden, where she grew up. In this novel, she is quite actively digging into London's history, trying to understand how a person like her, with European and Jamaican ancestry, came to exist here in the first place. What forces deposited black people on these shores? With her multicultural eye, she also gives us a London that is more racially mixed than that found in other novels about the period. A London of Lascar Indians, Africans, Chinese, Turks, black maids of all work and black cooks and housekeepers, and Carib boys in livery at the threshold of fine houses, got up like princes of Arabia. As always, it is a pleasure to be in Zadie Smith's mind, which, as time goes on, is becoming contiguous with London itself. Dickens may be dead, but Smith, thankfully, is alive. This review was written by Karan Mahajan, whose most recent novel, The Association of Small Bombs, was a finalist for the National Book Award. This book was one of the book review's 10 best books of 2023. Northwoods by Daniel Mason. Daniel Mason's historical fictions, including his 2020 story collection, A Registry of My Passage Upon the Earth, brilliantly combine the granularity of realism with the timeless, shimmering allure of myth. His new novel, Northwoods, promises and delivers more of the same. It begins with a pair of young lovers in colonial New England, escaping wrathful judgment in their Puritan village. They flee into the wilds of western Massachusetts, chased by solemn men with harquebuses cocked in their elbows. This is Hawthorne given an injection of breathless Edenic bliss. Micah dusted her heels like silver, damselflies upon her neck, flying squirrels in the trees above them, and in the silty sand the great tracks of cats. The lovers successfully abscond, yet North Woods is not about them. It is about the foundation stone they lay at the chapter's close, and the yellow house that comes to occupy the spot. The rest of this impossible-to-summarize novel introduces us to inhabitants of that house over the ensuing 3+ centuries. One of them is Charles Osgood, a Revolution-era loyalist and autodidact whose memoirs, subtitled Reminiscences of an Apple Man, chart his lifelong pomomania, an obsession with apples, that leads him to farm a luscious variety he christens Osgood's Wonder. When Charles dies, the house passes to his spinster daughters, Alice and Mary, whose fractious relationship ends in tragedy. After them, it goes to a motley succession of owners and visitors who include an abolitionist, a landscape painter, a wealthy manufacturer bent on turning the property into a luxury sportsman's lodge, and his schizophrenic grandson, whose medical travails are chronicled by a World War II-era lobotomist. Later still, we meet an elderly amateur historian who becomes convinced that bodies are buried on the property. As for the house, it thrives, lapses into disrepair, is abandoned, and revived, all the while serving as a not-quite-silent witness to the lives and deaths of its occupants. A third of the way through, Mason unexpectedly introduces ghosts, aligning his abode with fictional haunted houses from Hill House to Overlook Hotel. Northwoods is a hodgepodge narrative, brazenly disjointed in time, perspective, and form. Letters and poems and song lyrics, diary entries, medical case notes, real estate listings, vintage botanical illustrations, pages of an almanac, modern-day nature photographs, a true crime detective story, an address to a historical society. Mason stuffs all this and more into his bulging scrapbook of a novel. That Northwoods proves captivating despite its piecemeal structure is testament to Mason's powers as a writer, his stylish and supple narrative voice. The novel lives in its oddments, arrayed for us by an author-collector well-versed in pre-modern fruit farming, folk medicine, and popular songs through the ages, and language. Mason sprinkles early chapters with archaic words, and his ear for antique idioms is pitch-perfect. Across nearly 400 pages, we get involved in each of these lives, then move on. The only abiding players in this drama of ineluctable transformation are nature and time. The secret of North Woods, its blending of the comic and the sublime, lies in the way Mason deftly toggles between the macro and micro, managing to do both. He not only acknowledges cosmic indifference, but celebrates it, even as he pauses to recognize the humans who experience jubilation and heartbreak as they wend their way toward oblivion. This is fiction that deals in minutes and in centuries, that captures the glory and the triviality of human lives, the forest and the trees. Mason keeps both in clear view in his eccentric and exhilarating novel. This review was written by Rand Richards Cooper. He is the author of two works of fiction and a contributing editor for Common Wheel. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.